listening to the English language news of Kan, the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation. It's 8 p.m. in Israel, Thursday, March 28th, 2024. In the headlines, a gunman wounds three Israelis in an attack on the cars and school buses in the Jordan Valley. Israeli warplanes reportedly strike a pro-Iranian target near Damascus. Rocket is intercepted over Tzfat in western Galilee. Captured Islamic Jihad terrorist admits to raping Israeli women hostage. Prime Minister asked the High Court of Justice for more time to pass legislation for ultra-Orthodox draft exemptions. The National Security Council is warning Israelis against travel to Arab countries and Turkey. And the weather, cooler. Good evening, this is Arye O'Sullivan with the news. The manhunt continues for the gunman who carried out an attack this morning in the Jordan Valley north of Jericho. The terrorists opened fire at several vehicles as well as a bulletproof school bus. Three people, including a 13-year-old boy, were wounded in the shooting and are being treated at Shaarei Tzedek and Hadassah Mount Scopus hospitals in Jerusalem. One of the wounded listed was in moderate condition and the others were lightly hurt. Israeli security forces continued the search for the attacker. Witnesses described seeing an individual armed with a long-barreled rifle standing alongside the road. According to one image, he was wearing a military uniform. Khan reports that the terrorist was an officer in the Palestinian Authority security forces from Jenin. The bus drivers' union said in response to the shooting attack that buses are targets and steps must be taken immediately to staff every bus with a security guard, as was done in the past. In another part of the Jordan Valley, a driver burst through a checkpoint next to the village of Taisir today after refusing to undergo a security check by soldiers. A chase ensued and the security forces apprehended the driver. There were no injuries and the suspect was transferred for questioning. Turning to the north and the intensifying conflict going on there, throughout the day, intermittent rocket fire was directed on western Galilee. The IDF said that seven launches were detected and two were intercepted. A house in Shlomi was reportedly damaged. Hezbollah claimed responsibility. Also, a hostile air infiltration alert was sounded in the Upper Galilee communities. There were no reports of injuries or damage, and this came following a day after a rocket struck in Kiryat Shmona and killed one Israeli and wounded two others. In one incident today, a Patriot air defense system intercepted a suspicious aerial target over the city of Tzfat. Meanwhile, the IDF carried out a surprise exercise with its beefed-up troops in the north. The purpose of the exercise was to strengthen the IDF's readiness for various scenarios in the northern area, an IDF spokesman statement said. And Syrian media have reported that Israeli warplanes struck a building in the Damascus area this afternoon. Opposition Syrian sources said that the target was a site where pro-Iranian militiamen had concentrated. The Syrian Defense Ministry said that two people were injured and there was some material damage. IDF soldier Staff Sergeant Nisim Kahlon of Khadera, who fell in battle yesterday in South Lebanon, was laid to rest last night. Terrorists opened fire on Israeli security forces searching a building, in Gaza last night. They were searching a building in Khan Yunis and he was killed and another soldier was wounded. Since the outbreak of the war, 597 IDF soldiers have fallen. On day 174 of the war, the IDF and Shin Bet continue to operate in the El Amal region and the past day have killed terrorists and uncovered large quantities of weapons. At the same time, combat continues in the Shifa hospital. To date, some 200 terrorists have been killed around the hospital. The IDF says security forces take measures to prevent harm to patients, civilians, and medical staff. The Israeli security forces operating in Khan Yunis and the central Gaza Strip have killed dozens of terrorists, the army says. And the IDF Air Force destroyed a tunnel shaft and underground launch sites today. In an online briefing this afternoon, The IDF has released new interrogation footage of a Palestinian Islamic Jihad terrorist who confessed to raping an Israeli woman in a kibbutz in southern Israel during the Hamas-led October 7th onslaught. The terrorist was identified as Manar Qasim from the Islamic Jihad Naval Forces, who was captured in Khan Yunis at the beginning of March. In precise detail, he described how he entered a house on a kibbutz, armed with a pistol and two grenades. A woman asked for help. He said, "The devil took over me. I threw her on the sofa, started undressing her, and then I did what I did. I raped her. She pushed me, and it didn't last long." He said two members of the Hamas's Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade then showed up and took the woman and her mother. He returned to Gaza, saying he shot an Israeli on the way. The IDF says that the footage was further proof of the onslaught of murder and sexual violence by the terrorist organizations on October 7th, and it is an attempt to make the voices of those who can no longer tell be heard. The War Cabinet met yesterday for the first discussion in a week on the contacts on a hostage release deal. A diplomatic source said that Hamas' response to the proposal shows that Gaza leader Yahya Sinwar is not interested in a deal. A Khan reporter says some of those in the War Cabinet think the mandate of the Israeli delegation to the negotiations should be expanded, and American elements have voiced optimism despite the difficulties that it is possible to reach a deal. And Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu once again says that he is obligated to return all the abductees, and he clarified that he deals with this personally day and night. With that, in a meeting with the families of soldiers and female soldiers who were abducted to the Gaza Strip, Netanyahu emphasized that only the continuation of heavy military pressure will ensure the release of the abductees who are still in captivity. He noted that it was this pressure that led to the previous deal. "I know that every day that passes for you is hell," he said. "Your children are our heroes, the heroes of Israel." It was the first time that the prime minister had met with the parents of IDF soldiers since they were abducted on October 7th. Well, ahead of the meeting, parents issued a statement at the Tel HaShomer Army Induction Center. Here is Orna Neutra, mother of hostage Omer Neutra, an Israeli-American.
"In our meeting with the Prime Minister today, we demand to know when and how our sons will be returned. Those who are alive, as well as the bodies of those who are deceased and were murdered. We also demand to know that the teams involved in the negotiations have the tools and the leverages to bring them home by Passover."
Orna Neutra, mother of the IDF hostage Omer Neutra. Well, after canceling a trip by top aides to Washington this week, Prime Minister Netanyahu is now seeking to reschedule. A senior U.S. administration official said that Israel was interested in rescheduling the visit that was canceled after the U.S. abstained in a U.N. Security Council vote this week on a Gaza ceasefire. According to the reports, the visit could take place as soon as next week. Here's White House spokesperson Karine Jean-Pierre.
"What I can say on Israel more broadly, as you ask me about meetings that were held here, they were constructive discussions with Israel's defense minister over the last 2 days. Rafah was one of the many topics discussed with Jake Sullivan, Tony Blinken, Lloyd Austin, and Bill Burns. The prime minister's office has agreed to reschedule the meeting dedicated to Rafah. So we're now working with them to find a convenient date that's obviously going to work for both sides, but his office has agreed to reschedule that meeting that would be dedicated to Rafah, which is a good thing.
What are the sticking points on it?
So I can confirm that talks continue, and the United States is actively engaged in those conversations. We remain hopeful that we can broker a deal to secure the release of hostages and establish a temporary ceasefire. This is something that we've been asking for some time, a ceasefire. And this hostage deal obviously would allow us bring home some hostages to their family, to their loved ones, and they include American hostages as well. And as well, bring into Gaza that all-important humanitarian aid that is needed in Gaza on the ground. I don't have anything beyond that, but we can confirm that we continue to have this incredibly important conversation on getting that hostage deal, which would lead to a ceasefire."
White House spokesperson Karine Jean-Pierre. A senior Pentagon official says that the United States supports Israel's right to self-defense, but it does not want a regional war. In an interview with Khan, Pentagon spokesperson Patrick Ryder said the U.S. will continue to work with the Israelis to find a diplomatic solution to the situation. President Isaac Herzog said today that the unbreakable bond between Israel and the United States is as strong as ever and is irreplaceable. In a meeting with a delegation of U.S. Congress members from the Democratic Party, led by AIPAC, Herzog said Israel shares with the United States and its president, Joe Biden, the same objectives of eradicating terror, of bringing the hostages back home, and a vision of moving towards peace with Israel's neighbors.
"The United States of America has no greater friend than Israel, and Israel has no greater friends than the United States of America. I said it in my speech in front of the joint session of the House in 19th of July, just a few months ago. The world has turned since then upside down, but this unbreakable bond. This alliance is as strong as ever and is irreplaceable. We all have to understand it. We share the same objectives. We share the objective of eradicating terror, of fighting the empire of evil which emanates from Tehran and wants to undermine world law and order and is adverse directly to the national interests of the United States of America. Of course, is a clear enemy of ours too. We are here fighting on behalf of entire humanity and the entire free world to fight a vile, aggressive, and brutal terrorist organization which holds 134 Israeli hostages, which we are praying and acting and calling for their release every day. And we share with the United States of America and with the President of the United States of America, our dear friend, President Joe Biden, we share the same vision of eradicating terror, of bringing the hostages back home, of moving towards peace with our neighbors and finding it a possibility once we finish the ability of our enemies to carry out terror from Gaza against us. And finally, and most importantly, we share the vision of inclusion of Israel in the region, which I believe strongly in, including the normalization with Saudi Arabia. President Biden is a great friend of Israel. We have hosted him less than 2 years ago here when I honored him with the Israeli Presidential Medal of Honor. I could see his love and affection and emotion towards the people of Israel and the state of Israel. The tears coming down his eyes when he saw so many great moments here. He's a true friend and I respect him a lot for that. And I say to our friends in America and I say to the Israeli people, this bond is essential. Simply focus on upgrading, enhancing, and strengthening this bond, because this bond is a unique bond in world history of two nations who believe in true humanitarian values. We will work together to alleviate and upgrade the humanitarian aid to Gaza, and we will work together endlessly to bring the hostages back home, and we will work endlessly to fight terror, stand up to the empire of evil, and lead the world and the region toward a better future.
President Isaac Herzog. The president's wife, Michal Herzog, shared with the delegation her perspective as a mother who seeks a peaceful future for her children and as an Israeli woman who hopes that other women in the world will not have to go through the sexual violence Israeli women went through and are still going through in attacks and captivity.
I thank you again very much for coming here and expressing your solidarity. And I'm sure that what you've seen with your own eyes has even strengthened more your stand. And we do hope, we're very hopeful, that we will know peaceful days here, because this is what we yearn for. I can say as a mother, we want our kids to grow in a peaceful neighborhood. We want them to have a good future. We don't want to fight. We don't want to encourage conflicts. And as I said, as an Israeli woman, I pray that other women in the world will not have to go through the sexual violence that Israeli women went through and still are going through. And we pray every day for the hostages to come back safe and sound as quickly as possible. Thank you for being with us.
Michal Herzog, wife of President Isaac Herzog. In an online briefing this afternoon, Rakala Kramason of the National Public Diplomacy Directorate gave this update on the entry of humanitarian aid into the Gaza Strip.
We are allowing as much aid as possible. We are positively flooding Gaza with aid. Yesterday, 274 trucks of humanitarian aid were inspected and transferred into Gaza, with 164 of those carrying food. 25 of those food trucks were transferred into northern Gaza. Additionally, 156 packages, each weighing one ton, were airdropped over Gaza. These are the numbers of aid facilitation on our side, the Israeli side, in just the last 24 hours. To the UN, I would say, we are doing our part daily. Please do your part to ensure the aid is not stolen and reaches the innocent civilians who need it most. Also in the last 24 hours, a brand new field hospital with the capacity of 66 beds and a staff of 200 to provide comprehensive care opened in Gaza. This marks the seventh field hospital we have facilitated. This hospital will be run by the NGO UK Med, and they have already begun treating patients. This hospital will significantly enhance the medical response for civilians in Gaza.
Asked if Israel is prepared to go it alone should American administration support shift against the backdrop of the upcoming elections there, she answered in the affirmative.
Obviously, I have no comment on U.S. elections or domestic policy. I will say that, yes, Israel is prepared to go it alone if we need to, because this is a war for our very existence. And we will absolutely do everything to restore peace and security for our civilians. And yes, we will go it alone. But we do have support from our oldest friend, the United States, and we will continue to, you know, speak with them and get their guidance on ways to move forward. But yes, if need be, Israel will go alone.
Raquel Cramason of the National Public Diplomacy Directorate. In the nearly 6 months of war, most of the Gaza Strip, swollen with over a million refugees, is heavily damaged, with large swaths of urban areas destroyed and riddled with a vast network of destroyed Hamas tunnels. Many say it's uninhabitable for the near future, even if or when efforts start to rebuild begin. Sinai is the solution. Joel Roskin, a professor at the Department of Environment, Sustainability and Planning at the Bar-Ilan University, has proposed turning northern Sinai into at least a place on Earth that Gazans could settle, even temporarily, as it is an integral part of the Levant, with ample water sources and extensive infrastructure already laid by the Egyptians. I spoke with Roskin about the prospects of the Sinai solution.
They're going to go into a very long haul of waiting for Gaza to be rebuilt. I mean, the urban areas are shred. The underground is mutilated. The surface is churned and full of explosives and debris. And I mean, in the long run, their aspirations are not Gaza. Their aspirations are to return to Israel, where they were kicked out of after the invasion in 1948.
But you're saying right now that the Gaza Strip is too small and too demolished to rehabilitate for the moment, so you have to make some kind of idea to move the people or into an area maybe adjacent to Sinai?
I try to, you know, talk many geography, not politics.
Yes.
Because, I mean, it's clear the Egyptians have no interest. They never had interest in helping or evacuating or treating the Palestinians, and they got their way in 1979 with the peace treaty with Israel. They got their official border cutting through Rafah. So they have no political obligation at the moment. But I'm talking about geographical and geological facts. I mean, the contrast between Sinai right across the border to Gaza is wild, is outrageous. I mean, everything is churned, torn, dense, destroyed in Gaza, and you have these expanses right next door in Sinai. Not only that, the Egyptians have invested tremendous resources into developing Sinai for civilian and also for future military aspirations against us. So there's tremendous infrastructure there that's in a way not being used and can be utilized tomorrow.
So this is empty land. Is there water resources in that area?
Yeah, there's also high groundwater tables near the coast. There's also fossilized groundwater in the Sinai. I mean, in a way, Sinai is the northern and central Sinai is the continuation of the Negev, more or less. So as we can sustain population in the Negev, that can also be done in the Sinai. And of course, now it's so easy to gear up desalination plants along the coast. Mm-hmm. International money. You have a huge coast there. And, I mean, we're in a new era now.
I mean, the border between Egypt, Israel and Sinai, Israel and Egypt is this artificial line that was created in 1906 by the British, and it became the border. So, but as a geologist, the natural border is not there. It's sort of like the same vista, both sides, right?
Yeah, we're talking geologically about this micro tectonic plate called Sinai, Sinai-Israel microplate.
Mm-hmm.
Sinai, the Negev, and and the mountainous areas of Israel is one geological entity.
Yeah. So the northern Sinai, could that sustain a large Palestinian population?
Yeah. I mean, for example, the Saudis right now, east of the Tehran Straits, west of Tubuk, they're developing a 30-kilometer-long city right now. Wow. That's planned to house millions of people. Millions. 30 kilometers long. It's wild. So there's no problem to develop deserts nowadays. I mean, deserts, in a way, are mankind's future because they're the less affected areas on Earth.
So the only real reason is the Egyptian, their opposition to having any sort of Palestinians coming in there because they see the Palestinians as Muslim Brotherhood, Islamic fundamentalists. But what benefit would Egypt get if they opened up that northern part of the Sinai for the Palestinians?
Yeah, look, I'm not an expert on the geopolitical situation of Egypt, but they're in tremendous debt. I think close to like $400 billion of debt.
Mm-hmm.
They have a huge population growth that they can't control. They're dependent on so many types of loans and international support. So if this can generate more international support, that's when I'm hypothesizing, then I think this could be beneficial for Egypt.
Would they gain any better standing in the Arab world?
That's the whole thing. It's not only that's the whole problem. Not only the Egyptians are against this kind of proposal, also the Palestinians are, and I assume most of the Arab world, because in this sort of a demographic change, in a way we're reorganizing the Palestinian problem and trying to solve it, and that's the last aspiration and hope of most of the Arabs. They don't want this to be solved.
Could you see this Sinai being a temporary solution?
That's also a possibility.
Mm-hmm. In your talks and with people with this idea, what have people said?
I get a very polar reaction.
Mm-hmm.
I got a lot of reaction. A lot of Israelis and let's say Jewish North Americans were very excited about this. And then I got a lot of hate mail.
Oh, really?
A lot of hate mail. It was the worst things I've ever seen in my life written to me. Terrible things.
Why? I mean, you're raising a proposal. Why hate?
Yeah, but today, as we see what's going on in the world, I mean, there's no room here for debate. There's no room for talk. You know, there's anti-Semitism in its most lowest grade. And, I mean, they use all the words, you know, genocide, ethnic cleaving, and so on and so forth. But I think we have to push forward proposals. This is a big chance to make a change, because if not, the Gazans will just continue to suffer. I was even thinking right now, keep the Gazans in Gaza, okay, and they'll live in tents for the next 10 years and have zero economy. I mean, maybe that's better.
Professor Joel Ruskin of Bar-Ilan University. Well, in a dramatic step, the High Court of Justice this evening issued an interim order barring the government from funding the monthly stipends of at least some ultra-Orthodox yeshiva students after April 1st. This as the legal framework for deferring their military service will no longer exist. Earlier, Prime Minister Netanyahu made an exceptional plea to the court in a written request for a 30-day extension to pass legislation on exemptions for drafting ultra-Orthodox men. He noted to the court that considerable progress has been made on the issue. Haredi parties have objected to the inclusion of conscription quotas in the slated legislation. Meanwhile, National Unity Chairman Benny Gantz denied media reports that he offered the Haredi parties an extension of their long-standing IDF exemption in exchange for an agreement to hold national elections in 6 months. Well, tens of thousands of Haredi yeshiva students receive monthly stipends for the yeshiva studies, and these payments are of critical importance to the ultra-Orthodox political parties. But it looks like that yeshiva students who didn't get their military service deferral after July 1st last year and who have not presented themselves for conscription will now be ineligible for monthly stipends, this according to the court ruling tonight. We'll have to watch that story. Yesh Atid founder and opposition leader Yair Lapid was narrowly defeated his challenger, Ram Ben Barak, in the first ever primaries held today for the Yesh Atid party. Lapid won 52.5% of the vote and Ben Barak won 47.5%. Some 720 members of the party conference cast their vote today. The National Security Council has issued a revised travel advisory today ahead of the spring holidays, warning travel should be avoided to Turkey, Morocco, Egypt, including Sinai, and Jordan. The National Security Council statement said that these are countries where the potential for terrorist threats against Israelis and Jews since the beginning of the war is particularly high. The travel warning does not apply to those who were in these countries for the purpose of a connecting flight. Officials have also warned Israelis traveling to Sweden in May for the Eurovision 2024 Song Contest to make efforts to conceal their identities. The music contest will take place starting on May 5th with Israeli singer Eden Golan competing in the annual song contest. After months of uncertainty over Israel's participation amid protests and accusations of politicization, the National Security Council statement also states that since the beginning of the war, there have been increased efforts by Iran and its proxies to carry out terrorist attacks against Israelis and Jewish targets all over the world. And on that note, more than 1.2 million passengers are expected to pass through Israel's Ben-Gurion Airport during the month of April, according to an estimate by the Transportation Ministry. On the peak days of the Passover holiday, approximately 60,000 passengers are expected to pass through the airport each day on international flights. Well, taking us up to return headlines, to midway headlines, is this song by Daniela Spector, Lechiot, To Be. And now, a midway look at the major news headlines today. A gunman wounds three Israelis in an attack on cars and school buses in the Jordan Valley. Israeli warplanes reportedly strike a pro-Iranian target near Damascus, and rocket is intercepted over Tzfat and other rockets over Western Galilee. A captured Islamic Jihad terrorist from Khan Yunis admits to raping Israeli women hostage. The Prime Minister asked the High Court for more time to pass legislation for ultra-Orthodox draft exemptions, but the High Court, however, ordered just this evening the cessation of some yeshiva funding from April 1st. The National Security Council has warned Israelis against travel to Arab countries and to Turkey, and the weather cooler. High school students declared a strike today in protest over the sanctions imposed by teachers over the ongoing labor dispute between the Secondary School Teachers Union and the Finance Ministry. The students called for all parties to work for the well-being of the students and not to leave the negotiation room until there is a solution. Defense Minister Yoav Gallant and Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich have accepted an initiative of the IDF and the Forum of Career Soldiers to take up an assistance fund, to set up an assistance fund for the families of those forces who have suffered financially during the war. The fund will help them in cases of impact of wages of the spouses and will also help cover costs of psychological and emotional treatment for first-degree family members and services for children with special needs. In science, the Blavatnik Award for Young Scientists was announced this week. The prestigious award went to three scientists from the Weizmann Institute of Science in Israel in recognition of their groundbreaking work in various fields. Each recipient will also receive a $100,000 prize. We spoke with one of the recipients, Dr. Moran Shalev Ben-Ami, a senior scientist at the Weizmann Institute of Science, who is working on sensing and signaling mechanisms in the brain that may help treat appetite disorders.
Our lab works on the human brain. I mean, we are at the Department of Chemistry, but we're working a lot on biology. So we're recognized at determining the three-dimensional structures of several key proteins that compose the brain.
What'd you discover?
So we were working on several different aspects of the human brain, but I think that the one that is of most interest to the audience is the key protein that is in charge on the hunger mechanism. Basically, it's the molecular switch that decides whether we are hungry or not.
Wow. So what do you hope to do with that type of knowledge?
So what we hope to do is, of course, to understand how this protein works. Mm-hmm. And more importantly, we want to understand what happens when this protein doesn't work anymore because you have a mutation that would ultimately cause in illness, and we would like to learn how to fix it when it doesn't work properly.
Interesting. The Blavatnik Award is given to young scientists in Israel. How does getting an award like yourself help you?
Well, it gives you a boost of energy first to be recognized, but more importantly, it gives you now opportunities to try new things. It really gives you the energy to try and do some new stuff that are a bit dangerous in a very early career stage.
You're a young Israeli scientist. And Israel, you're part of this group of Israel, is known to be a powerhouse, a greenhouse for young scientists with breakthroughs in technology. Why do you think Israel is producing people like you?
I'm not sure Israel is producing people like me.
I mean, they talk about the startup nation.
That's true, but I think that Israel teaches us to be very independent and very out-of-the-box thinkers from a very young age. I think we feel it at our school systems. Of course, when we serve the military, so you leave the house very early, you have to be very independent, and I think it gives us some other characteristics.
Really? I mean, understand that hierarchy also isn't like it is in Israel, like elsewhere. I mean, you can approach anybody you want here, right?
That's true. This is part of the Israeli chutzpah, right?
Do you find that helps you in your scientific research?
I mean, yeah, it helps to dare, you know, to dare to approach people, even if they're really big and famous, and you can just write an email or make a phone call and connect. And these connections are very important. So in a way, yeah, it does.
Well, congratulations on receiving the award.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Moran Shalev Ben-Ami, one of the three recipients of the prestigious Blavatnik Award for Young Scientists. The two other awards went to Shraga Schwartz and Thomas Vidic. The Israel Prize Ceremony will take place this year on Independence Day in Sderot. The Ministry of Education announced today six more winners of the award. The entrepreneur Eyal Waldman, Chief Rabbi Yitzhak Yosef, Professor Gershon Ben-Shachar, Professor Haggai Bergman, Professor Vitali Milman, and Professor Yaakov Ritov. We have more news coming up, but first this song, by the Dudaim and Apovarim. See if you can guess what it is.
Ruach Ki, 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 Ruach Ki,
Studying the culture in a covert laboratory under the streets of Tel Aviv, Akiva Cohen, an Israeli scientist, clones Hitler from old samples of his DNA. Akiva wants to change the world for the good, but he is betrayed by those who want to use this new Hitler for unimaginable terror. This is the premise for Alex Sinclair's debut novel, Perfect Enemy, a thriller that takes a deep dive into Israeli society and raises probing questions about trauma and revenge, the desire for peace, religious extremism, and the schisms of the Middle East. Sinclair is a British-Israeli educator and lecturer who has written and spoken widely on Jewish education, Israel diaspora relations, and Israeli politics. He spoke to our reporter, Naomi Segal, about the book, in resonance of the post-October 7th reality and his foray into fiction writing.
It's a thriller, for sure. It's got a bit of politics in it, a bit of romance, a bit of kind of, not exactly sci-fi, but kind of like science-y kind of elements to it. And it's really a thriller set in Israeli society, about Israeli society. The premise of the book is that you have an Israeli scientist called Akiva Cohen, who has somehow managed to clone Hitler, some old samples of Hitler's DNA. You know, the book is really sort of then what happens. Akiva's part of this team, and there are other people in the team. As you can imagine, things don't go straightforwardly. There are all kinds of other characters as well. And really, the book's really becomes a science-y part, the kind of cloning part, kind of fades into the background a little bit, and the book becomes a thriller, which, like I said, touches on aspects of Israeli politics and Israeli society. It's kind of asking the question, really, you know, how do we respond to trauma? You know, what do you do? You know, we live as people who live in the shadow of the Holocaust. After October the 7th, we live in the shadow of all kinds of other, you know, traumatic events that we've been going through the past months. How do you respond to that trauma? You know, what do you respond? How do we as a people kind of respond to those kinds of those parts of our psyche? And the book kind of explores that in a pretty exciting, suspenseful way, with some lots of twists and turns.
Now, you wrote this book before October 7th. Actually, you started writing it a few years ago. It is, in some ways, a deep dive into Israeli society and ideology and politics. Before October 7th and after October 7th, do some of the messages already in the book, do they resonate differently for you?
I think on a certain level, the answer has to be yes. You know, I think everything resonates differently for me. I'm sure for you as well, for all Israelis. You know, I mean, I joke that the way I tie my shoelaces now is different from the way I did on October the 6th. It's not a joke. It's kind of sort of the devastating thing to say, but kind of we go around, everything in life is different. So on the one hand, it is different. And on the other hand, most of the stuff that the book is talking about is stuff that's even more relevant today. I mean, I'll give an example. One of the kind of themes that the book raises and grapples with is the rise of the extremist right wing in Israeli society. You know, there's one of the characters in it is a kind of Bezalel Smotrich, Itamar Ben Gvir kind of character, or at least somebody who comes from that kind of world. You know, and pre-October the 7th, I at least, you know, found those kinds of, you know, those I find that kind of worldview, that kind of political and religious worldview, really troubling and problematic and deeply concerning for me, at least, and for the kind of Israel and the kind of Jewish people that I want to see. And the book kind of really kind of plays with that. And you know, I think post October the 7th, those kinds of issues got quietened for a little bit as we all got really, you know, consumed by the initial stages of the war and the hostages, etc. But now I think we're seeing those issues bubble to the surface again in Israel. And I think, look, you know, right now Israel faces an external struggle with Hamas. You know, we face an external struggle with people who literally want to kill us. And we have to win that struggle. But we also face an internal struggle, which is, I would call it a struggle for the soul of the Jewish people. And for the sort of what we want Jewishness and Judaism and Jewishness in Israel to look like. And, you know, that's one that the book really kind of grapples with. It kind of, you know, it's not exactly right versus left, but it really kind of puts that kind of worldview in front of the readers face and says, okay, you know, what are you going to do about this? What do you think about this? So that's one of the issues that the book raises.
Now, you've dealt with these issues and ideas in your professional life as a Jewish educator, a lecturer, someone who's very involved in Israel diaspora relations. You've written about this from a nonfiction perspective. Mm-hmm. What made you decide to take the plunge into fiction, and when did that begin?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I taught at the Jewish Theological Seminary for many, many years and taught classes on Israel education. And like you said, I wrote a book, and you know, a kind of academic education book, and many articles about how we teach Israel and how we talk about Israel. I guess at some point I felt that I'd said everything I had to say from a nonfiction perspective. You know, I felt like I was writing stuff that was just rewritten versions of things that I've said previously, and I kind of felt that, you know, I'd said everything I wanted to say, and a lot of the stuff I was reading were, you know, I think even today, you know, I still feel like I read an article or an op-ed in the press, and it's like, oh, that's just another version of what that person wrote a year ago or 2 years ago. So I wanted to try something else. I've always had this sort of one of my favorite Hebrew phrases is that, you know, I have a juk barosha, literally a cockroach in my head, which is a great phrase. And I always had this cockroach in my head that I might try to write something, some fiction. And then I had this crazy idea, which was the kind of kernel for the book, and then began writing. And then the rest is history. There's a cute little story. Actually, this is actually the second piece of fiction I ever wrote. The first piece of fiction I ever wrote was published when I was 10 years old, and I won a competition in London where I grew up that was run by Capital Radio, which was London and it still is London's main kind of music radio station. It was a competition to write a fairy tale for Princess Diana. She was pregnant at that stage with her first baby, with Prince William, who became then Prince William. And I was one of six winners out of I don't know how many thousand entries. And it was presented to Princess Diana for her to read as a bedtime story to Prince William. So I don't know if she ever did read my story as a bedtime story to Prince William. But that was the first story that I ever wrote for publication. This is the second.
So from fairy tales to thrillers, you certainly can't be boxed into a certain kind of genre.
It's true. And it's a thriller, but it's also got some kind of funny scenes in it as well, and some good characters. It's a plot driven sort of suspense novel, but it's got some great characters in it. So there's another couple of characters in a young female Israeli politician who's in a relationship with a Palestinian businessman from East Jerusalem, and her name is Hadass, his name is Omar, and Hadass and Omar, they become really kind of central protagonists in the book as well. There's a kind of the book has these kind of two parallel storylines. One is with Akiva, the scientist, and his funder, a guy by the name of Yoav, and Yoav is the kind of Bezalel Smotrich kind of character, and that runs in parallel to the Hadass Omar storyline. And then at some point the storylines weave together. Obviously I can't say how, because that would be spoilers, but Hadass and Omar are a major protagonist in the book as well.
So would you say you're trying to convey a message through this book and this very exciting plot, or raise questions for the readers about Israel through these various types?
I think more raise questions. Look, I really wanted the book to do two things. I wanted it to be a fun, exciting read, and for people to, even people who don't know Israel, I mean, the book's not written for Jewish people per se, it's written for a general audience. I think that even people who don't know Israel at all will enjoy it as a just a kind of fun, exciting thriller. And I wanted it to raise questions. I don't think it has a message. I think in a way it has the opposite of a message. It raises questions without kind of coming down. I mean, none of the characters escape, with kind of unblemished moral records. They all get into situations which kind of force them into, you know, to make problematic decisions of one sort or another. So nobody comes out with a clean bill of health, as it were. And it raises questions about the right. It raises questions about the left. It raises questions about the Palestinians as well, and about their kind of struggle between moderates and extremists. So So it kind of, I hope it kind of leaves the reader having had a great time reading it, and also with a whole bunch of kind of questions to think about Israel and Israeli society and the conflict with the Palestinians and so on.
And you're headed on a book tour soon.
I'm headed on a book tour. I'm going to be in the States in April, in a week and a half, in the beginning part of April. And I'll be at about five different places talking about the book and talking also a little bit about using the book as a springboard to talk a little bit about Israeli society. So the website is alexjsinclair.com/perfectenemy. So if you go there to alexjsinclair.com/perfectenemy, then you see a list of the places that I'm going to be speaking.
Alex Sinclair, author of Perfect Enemy. As Catholics mark the Holy Week, culminating in Easter Sunday, many faithful attended the washing of the feet ceremony at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem today. Listen. The ceremony was led by the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem, Pier Battista Pizzaballa. The washing of the feet symbolizes Jesus' teaching that leaders are servants. Former U.S. Senator Joe Lieberman has died at the age of 82. A staunch supporter of Israel and former vice presidential candidate, Lieberman was considered one of the highest-ranking Jewish figures in the American political system. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu eulogized Lieberman as an exemplary public servant, an American patriot, and a matchless champion of the Jewish people and the Jewish state. In a complex operation, the Arava rescue team retrieved a lone eagle egg from a nest after the two parents were poisoned and died. The team rappelled down a cliff face and managed to transfer the egg to the Nature and Parks Authority incubator. It's due to hatch in the coming weeks. And this announcement, Israel moves to summertime tonight at 2 a.m. The night between Thursday and Friday, clocks will be moved forward 1 hour to 3 a.m. Spring ahead. And taking us up to return headlines is a song by Ehud Banai, Ish Hatzel, Man of the Shadows.
את ישבתי לבדי על גדות נהר אפל כיף לעומתי במים איש הצל קיללתי וברך בכיתי וצחק ניסיתי להתקרב הוא שמע ומרחק אתה תמיד יודע מה לומר עם חליפה ומגבעת חלפת על פניי בריקוד עולץ אני ניסיתי להסתיר אתה חשפת הכל אני שתקתי אתה פתחת בגדול לבדי על גג מגדל בבל בשמי הלילה מעליי הבזיק כוכב נופל נשארתי במקום הוא חתך את האוויר קולי היה חסום הוא התחיל לשיר מחליק את המצבים לוקח בקלות לא פוחד לתפוס גלים לרכב על רוח שטות אני נשארתי אלמוני אתה כבר מפורסם אני קרוע ושבור אתה כמעט מושלם
Taking a look at the weather, and cooler tomorrow, mostly in the center and the south, but still warm for the time of the year. Chance of local rain in the afternoon hours, mostly light in the north and the east. Temperatures forecast for the main regions, Jerusalem 17 to 24, Tel Aviv 14 to 23, Haifa 19 to 23, Tzfat 19 to 24, Tiberias 13 to 32, Beersheba 18 to 27, and in Eilat from 20 tonight going up to 32 degrees centigrade tomorrow. Now, another look at the main news headlines today. A gunman wounds three Israelis in an attack on cars and school buses in the Jordan Valley. Israeli warplanes reportedly strike a pro-Iranian target near Damascus. A rocket is intercepted over Tzfat and another one over the Western Galilee. Captured Islamic Jihad terrorist admits to raping Israeli women hostage on October 7th. The Prime Minister asked the High Court for more time to pass legislation for ultra-Orthodox draft exemptions, but the High Court this evening has ordered the halt of stipends from April 1st to yeshiva students eligible for the draft. The National Security Council warns Israelis against travel to Arab countries and to Turkey, and the weather cooler. That's the news. Join us again tomorrow night at 8 p.m. on Kanreka, the foreign languages channel of the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation. Watch our 2 p.m. news flash on the Khan English Facebook page, or you can write to us at khanenglish@khan.org.il. Together with sound engineer David Maran, this is Aryeh O'Sullivan wishing you a good evening and shalom from Jerusalem.